You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 114.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
All right, welcome everyone to another episode of The Local Maximum. Another exciting episode, episode 114. Today I'm joined by my co-host, Aaron. Aaron, how you doing?
Doing pretty well, all things considered. Enjoyed an overall pleasant Easter weekend.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's good to, I have a lot of, actually now I have some interesting guests coming up, but it's always important for me to kind of not make this a pure interview show and to come back in and check with the, check in with the audience, talk about what we learned and talk about stuff. We did a lot of show prep today, but we talked about, are we going to talk more about coronavirus, the epidemic, COVID-19, all, I don't know how you talk about it. And we decided that, let's try to talk about it a little less today because we've been getting it so much.
It's going to be hard to avoid, but it's not going to be our focus.
Right. There have been a lot of people who have asked me to weigh in on the epidemic modeling because, you know, there are, the story from the federal level is, well, first these models said millions of people would die, then it said 100,000s, now it says 60,000s. What's going on? Were the models done poorly? Were they explained poorly? And in order to dive into that, I actually have to dive into what those models are actually doing, which I haven't done yet. So give me a break. I'm going to try, because I think like a lot of people are just giving hot takes on this. Like they're making assumptions about what happened rather than actually.
Are you telling me that hot takes are not the best takes?
Well, you know, I don't want to make an assumption about what actually happened before I look into what actually happened. And then, because I know that a lot of the takes that I was saying, you know what, maybe I should leave this up to other people to talk about. But then when I looked at what the other people were doing, I said, nope, they're screwing it up too much. I'm going to have to do it myself, but I'll do it in a different episode.
And while we may not be always purely an evidence-based podcast, we try to make clear what is opinion and what is evidence-based.
Yeah, no, I shoot from the hip sometimes. And sometimes I think the audience of this podcast is smart. I think that they can tell when I'm shooting from the hip or when I'm just talking to you and having a good time, like I was just saying what's on the top of my mind in my living room or whatever, versus some well-researched stuff. Everything we do is kind of, and we're going to talk about this today in terms of the Potiverse.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's going to come up later, so keep that in mind.
Yeah, everything is on a spectrum, and it's important that the audience knows what it is. I think the way we present ourselves here on The Local Maximum and given the where the audience is at, I think the audience is smart enough to know when to take me more and less seriously. That's all I'm going to say. I think the modeling is important to talk about. I've been really frustrated by reading coronavirus takes online. I mean, it's, you know, you have all these people dying here in New York, and now I have a lot of people online who are still in denial, and they're like, well, where I'm like is nothing like New York, you know? And it's like, okay, that's true. Maybe less people will die where you are, hopefully. But to see people go from, oh, come on, two people have died, this is not a big deal, to, oh, come on, 10,000 people have died, this is not a big deal. It's like, when are you going to admit, like, you know, hey, sometimes bad things happen. And then there's the other side. There's the ultra alarmists who never want to open up anything. And once again, we have like this binary distinction, and it's hard to walk the rope in the middle where you actually look at the evidence and decide what to do, which is a lot of people don't want to do that because you actually have to learn about what's going on rather than just using your preconceived biases and, make a determination. But a lot of people online don't want to do that right now, which is it's frustrating. Maybe I should just step back a little bit.
I have so many things I want to say in response, but none of them will lead us further down our agenda for this show. So I'm going to compartmentalize that and move on.
Okay. So you want to talk about who's taking, who wants to take photos of our buttholes? Is that what this is about? How did we get into that?
When you put it that way, it almost sounds less disturbing than it actually is.
Well, tell me about this, because so this is a kind of a funny thing to start out with. So I like these kind of big data concerns, privacy concerns, emerging technology. And I've heard something about this before, but what is it you found about the smart toilet? Is that what it is?
I think it's part of a smart toilet system. And I'm looking for here's the money phrase. And so I'm looking at the abstract of this paper, which was published on April 6th of 2020.
Proposed by the Stanford School of Medicine, Stanford.
Yeah. So the journal is Nature Biomedical Engineering. And the title of the paper is A Mountable Toilet System for Personalized Health Monitoring Via the Analysis of Excreta. And the so-called the money quote in the abstract here is, each user of the toilet is identified through their fingerprint and the distinctive features of their anoderm.
What is an anoderm?
Yada yada is actually important here. And the data are securely stored and analyzed in an encrypted cloud server. So the article that led me to this, or the blog post that led me to this, was talking about how even anonymized data can be basically reverse engineered. So whatever it is that they're collecting here and storing is only as secure as we choose to believe it is. That if someone with sufficient resources and ingenuity is absolutely could reverse engineer this. Okay. Now the anoderm, to put it scientifically, is the bottom part of the anus. It's the last mile of it's the last mile of the digestive tract. So they, in addition to your fingerprint on your fingers, they are fingerprinting your butthole to identify you and match your medical records and what is coming out of you for scientific analysis, which I suppose I should be more disturbed by the fact that they're collecting all this medical data. But what pushes
are they collecting it yet, or are they just proposing it?
Well, I don't think this is a system that has been, you know, this is a scientific paper,
right?
not a Silicon Valley startup yet.
But there have been crazy startups before. It's only a matter of time.
Absolutely. And actually, when I saw this, my first reaction was, has this blogger fallen victim to the classic, somebody shared something from The Onion, and I didn't realize it was The Onion, because there actually was, and I had to look it up to figure out what the name of it was, but there was an infomercial on Adult Swim back in November of 2014 for a product called Smart Pipe, which is pretty much exactly this. And the infomercial, it's 11 minutes, it's worth a gander, but they make fun of the fundamental concept of this technology, as well as the concept of governmental and congressional oversight, as well as the whole startup culture and the idea of disrupt and
Back up a little bit.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Back up a little bit, because I think people just want to know how this works. It's a smart toilet. You sit down on it, and there's a camera on the bottom of the toilet that takes a picture up at you. Is that how this is working?
So I can't claim to have actually purchased and read the entire paper. So I'm working off the extract, but it does sound that in fact there is some way of photographing your butthole to identify you.
All right.
But in addition to that, it also has, let's see here, the smart toilet, which is self-contained and operates autonomously by leveraging pressure and motion sensors, analyzes the user's urine using standard of care colometric assay that traces red, green, blue values from images, yada, 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 yada. So basically they're going to test your urine. They're going to test your poop.
And
they're
going to
read it on the Bristol stool scale, which I'll give them this, that using the Bristol stool scale can give you some very valuable information about your overall digestive health.
Oh, sure, sure. And they know, they know they're using those pictures or those images or whatever, those scans of your tuchus to know who you are. So they're going to compare you with millions of other profiles, shall we say.
Well, it is part of what they say is that this should be equivalent to the analysis work that a trained medical personnel could provide.
Okay.
So perhaps they're looking at cutting out the analyst, the doctor, or the lab tech, which might be desirable to some. But I think the reason, and it's unclear whether they would be collecting your data and comparing it to tens, hundreds, thousands, millions of other people. Although, if this were to become a startup, then obviously they would, because who doesn't want the big data?
Right.
But my take on it is that the digital fingerprint of your anus is being used because rarely does a toilet serve a single user.
Right.
Perhaps those of us that live in one bedroom apartments are an exception to the rule there. But usually
my toilet
in a home.
Every time I have a guest, they'll use the toilet immediately. I don't know what it is.
Right, and you don't want your health analysis being tainted. I feel bad about that choice of words already. by the output, the input of another user, and so
it's
being
both
able
output
to identify.
And input.
Yeah. So being able to your output input to the receptacle, but yeah, being able to identify from whence it came is useful there. Why they need to do that using this particular method, especially if they claim to also have access to fingerprints,
right?
Seems unnecessary.
It's like, well, you log super... in, yeah, like you can log in whenever you do it or something, and tell them who you are rather than having it scan you.
There are plenty of systems which we log into electronically already. Any system that has, you know, a retinal scan isn't using that for the convenience of the user, so they don't have to type in a password. It's for added levels of security.
Ah, okay. But if it's in your own home, it might not be that necessary.
Face recognition on iPhones and Android phones is maybe a step in a different direction. I'm letting my bias towards defense industry security drive me there. That use of biometrics in that paradigm is never for the user's convenience. It's to provide additional security. And in this case, I don't think you're worried about somebody sneaking into your home and maliciously logging in as you to your toilet and then providing additional data.
Maliciously
to skew
bombing
your results.
My toilet. You haven't met my cousins, but anyway. they don't listen to the show. If they do,
I've intentionally eaten no fiber for weeks, and then I'm going to come visit you and screw up your data pool.
Yeah, so anyway, when I first listened to this and I saw the parody as well, the people who wrote the parody actually got this from other places, because this idea has been going on for a while. I read Michio Kaku. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a physicist, a futurist. I think he lives here in Brooklyn. I think he's in the CUNY system. So he's on a lot of you could watch a lot of physics documentaries and stuff. He wrote a book called The Future of Humanity, and I think it was in that book. It's been maybe 10 years since I read it. But he would talk about, having a smart toilet in the future where, you'd use it, and then essentially everyone would know when you have cancer like years earlier than any test could. And, you'd just be able to know things and monitor your health and stay healthy just from your smart toilet. So it seems like it would be a no-brainer to get it if it helps you with your health. And then all of a sudden, we're all indexed.
Yeah, I can't argue with that there are definite medical benefits that could be provided by this system. The thought of it taking pictures of buttholes it pushes me over the edge. And two, the source that I found this through, Joe Huffman's blog, which I think I've mentioned on the show before. He is coming from a world where he is very focused on security in a digital world. And so, his take on the fact that when all this data is being collected, even if it's in a anonymized and secure database, with sufficient effort and manpower, or not really manpower, machine power, you can de-anonymize a database. And if we're going to put all of our sensitive medical records out there like this, I would very much like to know if I have impending cancer, particularly if there are things I can do to minimize the impact in the road up to that, years in advance. Do I want my employer? Do I want my insurance? Do I want Russian hacker trolls to know this information? Not really. And once it's out there, I can't pull it back up through the toilet.
It's kind of scary. It's like, oh my God, they're all going to know, aren't they? They're all going to have the, that's the future.
I can't imagine that a smart toilet like this would not be a connected toilet.
Oh yeah.
Even if they're doing everything else right, you have all the problems of the Internet of Things introduced, which I know we've talked about before, that there are huge risk surfaces involved there.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's a link to this particular episode I have on that, but maybe we'll find it after the show. Local media.
Much like there are people who refuse to drive a car with any sort of computer in it, and so they're valuing those late 60s, early 70s automobiles, the type of car that will survive an EMP blast. I would not be surprised if there comes a time when there are holdouts, there are Luddites who will only poop in an analog toilet.
An analog toilet. Just the idea that we have to talk about analog toilets sounds.
My bathroom is inside a Faraday cage.
Yeah, I guess so. All right. Well, what do you guys think of this? localmaxradio@gmail.com if you want to weigh in. localmaxradio.com/114 if you want to get some of the if you want to get the links. And I'll try to be very thorough on the links to this article because I think there are a lot of good ones. Let's talk about this Guardian article from last year. So this is a good time to return to something, an important trend.
From the before times.
Well, yeah, from the before times. November 27th, 2019. And I read this article. I was like, oh, this is such a dumb article. Because it's talking about podcasting. Podcasting, obviously, as a podcaster, very important platform to me. It's also very important as a tech platform, as a media platform. What's going on in business, what's going on in politics, all of this is coming to a head in podcasting. And so a lot of old media have something to say about it. The Guardian article, what is the subtitle? What's the overall title? Shoot, I didn't write the overall title here, did I? I think I missed it. I don't even remember where I linked to it. Anyway, the Guardian article says bedroom broadcasters are pumping out pods unchecked. A pod is a podcaster, by the way, not tied pod, podcast. Bedroom broadcasters are pumping out pods unchecked. I don't like the term pods, by the way. I don't. Other podcasters like it. I just find
No one likes it. No one likes podcast either. But yeah. But
podcast sounds better.
Both it is become ingrained, and nobody has a better alternative to substitute in for it.
It's check out the pod to me is equivalent to someone on YouTube saying smash that like button. I just don't like it.
Here we go. So the headline is Are podcasts a disaster waiting to happen? And the subtitle is bedroom podcasters are pumping out pods unchecked, and now some are being accused of plagiarism, voyeurism, and even scuppering lawsuits. Is this booming industry doomed?
We're doomed,
they
Aaron.
Don't stretch out doomed. We're doomed. But that was my editorialization.
Yeah. No. So. Overall impression, this is a classic case of old media snubbing their nose at new media, even though old media is the problem or has many of the same problems. We've been through this with bloggers 15 years ago at this point. We've been through this with the blogosphere. We've been through this with just internet websites 20 years ago, with Monica Lewinsky and all that. They're going to argue. They already have a playbook on this. They're going to argue that podcasting is a bad source of news and information. Newspapers like us are the only way to go. They use the phrase Wild West. Wild West is a very good catchphrase that is always used when you're like, there's too much freedom going on here. We've got to use the phrase Wild West.
It's suspect when it comes from something like The Guardian, because anytime they use Wild West, it's definitely a pejorative about those cowboy Americans.
Yeah. Again, I don't want to make too many assumptions about, I'm not really making assumptions about the UK. I'm more making assumptions about Guardian in the UK, which I don't know if my impression of The Guardian is really correct, but maybe those of you who are in the UK can correct me on that. But, they clearly want to send in the legal system. They want to bring law and order to podcasters, whether it's the British legal system or the European legal system, kind of like a GDPR for podcasts, I can imagine. All the things that make the internet less fun. And I say European legal system. I know that the UK is no longer in the EU, although I think that The Guardian, I'm pretty sure The Guardian was not for that, were they? I'm just taking a guess. They want the podcast police, and they want the podcast police now. I don't like when people say, so you're saying this when they're not really saying that. But that's kind of what it sounds like. Am I being unfair here?
Well, that's definitely the vibe I get from it. And I don't know that this is particularly an editorial. It's in the culture and the TV and radio section.
Right.
But it's probably worth pointing out that the author here, Jack, I assume his last name is pronounced Seal. His bio is his short bio, at least, is that he's a freelance journalist specializing in TV. He writes regularly for The Guardian and Radio Times. He is in multiple dimensions part of the legacy media. And I think particularly his involvement in radio would lead him to be heavily biased against podcasts.
Right. Although not all radio
is. It's kind of the modern variant on pirate radio.
Right. Not all radio is. A lot of radio hosts and programs have translated very nicely into podcasting. I think it's interesting because 2020 clearly brings a whole new set of challenges to the media landscape with what's going on. So we should remember what they're saying in 2019. Is it still relevant? Not all the problems that they bring up in this article should be ignored. They're real problems. It's important to ask, compared to what? So there's plagiarism. Have newspapers been known to do plagiarism? Have blogs done plagiarism? Have radio hosts plagiarized?
Have political candidates plagiarized?
No, they're beyond that. They would never do that. I do think that you have to ask kind of a compare to what question. And so they bring up a few examples where I almost feel like the examples prove the rule, because one is comedians, right? It's the Dollop podcast. It's a U.S. history podcast. They apparently lifted one of their routines from someone else, and then that someone else got mad, and then it's like, okay, comedians using someone else's joke. Ha ha, this has happened before.
Well, and forgive me, because it's been a while since I've read the article here. But I believe the criticism of the Dollop wasn't even that they lifted a joke.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry to them if I'm wrong then.
No, their spiel is that they one host there are two hosts. One comes into the episode with no information about what they're going to talk about, or maybe just the title of the episode, and the other has this crazy story from history, either about a person or a particular event, and lays out the details, and the other kind of reacts in real time. It's a little bit like Drunk History in a sense,
okay.
Except they're not necessarily shit-faced, and it's audio, not video, and it tends to run longer than a Drunk History segment. So I believe what they did was the one host that was providing the historical content heavily utilized another content creator's material. Basically he was reading off their script for the historical. The factual content, and at least initially did not provide a reference saying that this is where they got that info from, and so it could very easily be perceived as they were passing it off as their own research.
Got it.
It wasn't quite the same as taking, I'm going to read you the this Wikipedia article and get your reaction, but it wasn't that far off from that, and it sounds like after they got called on it, they did go back and give credit where credit was due. But that does not appear to be sufficient for the aggrieved party.
Okay, so that proves my point even more. It just doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal. I'd be really happy if someone took my thing, and then I'd ask for, like, it's not like if they asked for more of an attribution, I'm sure the people would have given it to them, or they did.
I've never been to their webpage. I've listened to a couple episodes for unrelated reasons. But I don't know if they provide copious, you know, show notes with references there or not. And if it was just a matter of they didn't say it out loud in the audio, which that I could see that as being poor form if you provide a reference, but you have to dig for it to know who actually came up with it.
Right. I try to make mine dealing with this.
Yeah, we've been struggling with this fair use concept for well on a decade now. And there are some degrees of it that are, you know, just poor form, and there are some that are actively malicious. Like, what was the term for, it wasn't freebooting, but it was when people were taking things like from YouTube and then reposting them on Facebook so that they could monetize it, and the original content creators were getting no credit for it because Facebook doesn't pay out the way that YouTube does. And or when I know there was a long running thing of people would post other people's blog content or photos or web comics, and they would not only would they not give a link back to the original source, but sometimes they would go in and they would Photoshop out, you know, the watermark or the signature or the copyright, symbol on it, which
that goes
from being, you know,
that's malicious,
not great, to being actively malicious.
Right. But, you know, I look at this example and I'm like, this is the threat to society that podcasts pose, according to The Guardian. I mean, what?
Yeah. Well, as you alluded to before, this is not a podcast problem. Comedy has a longstanding cultural problem with plagiarism.
Yeah.
With people stealing people's jokes, whether intentionally or not, and that creating huge beefs. And because of the nature of the industry, it's really difficult to go out and pursue a lawsuit against somebody and actually get damages when they stole your comedy routine.
Yeah. Okay. So, what else? What's the other example they have? The other example they have is true crime. It's people who are trying to they're trying to be citizen journalists. They're trying to see. Well, I you know, honestly, true crime is a big, big podcast topic right now. It's been for a while. It's one of the biggest, and I don't listen to it.
Serial was kind of the breakthrough
But I'm just gonna say,
podcasts a thing for everybody.
I don't listen to it. I don't get into it, so I don't know enough about it. But I imagine it's just people who are like, I am going to take matters into my own hands, and I'm going to study this case, which either the legal system didn't do properly or didn't handle properly, or the police didn't handle properly, or detectives didn't handle properly. I'm going to do citizen journalism, and I'm going to find out what really happened. And they're like, oh, well, it's just people who are poking around where they don't belong. This sounds like it's probably a good thing for society to have.
Yeah, and I guess I'm speaking from a point of ignorance to some extent, because I never listened to Serial, and I don't think the closest thing I probably have to have listened to a true crime podcast is actually the Slow Burn podcast, which I highly recommend. I think it actually came out of Slate. So they're straddling that old media, new media barrier. And that was, at least in its original production, was purely a podcast product. However, it was coming out of an established media organ. I mean, the first season was about the Watergate scandal, and that came out in what, 2017. So it wasn't the kind of true crime that they're talking about here, which I think is particularly interested in kind of the ongoing case, or the case that not all the answers were provided. This is an open and shut case when we're talking about Watergate. It's more that the people of my generation, our generation, we didn't live through it. And so there are a lot of things about how it actually went down that we maybe don't get the nuance of. And the people who did live through it, maybe the benefit of decades of further research and the ability to go back and see it through the lens of history as opposed to what as it was actively unfolding can add dimension to it. Right. And I think those are valuable services that can be provided both in the form of a podcast and in the form of long form investigative journalism or nonfiction literature. I don't see what particularly separates the true crime podcast from these other forms that deal with digging into criminal activity and the judicial system, other than perhaps the fact that you can get to press a lot faster with a podcast for something that's currently occurring.
Right.
And maybe some of the concern there is that the traditional media feels that they're getting their feet stepped on because the nightly news can't do an hour-long segment or 12-hour-long segments over the course of 12 weeks on a particular case when they've got 1 hour to cover all the news.
A lot of these, the true crime podcasters and also the comedy podcasters are not getting paid that much to do it. They can afford to cover these minor stories that are of human interest that maybe the mainstream media, I don't like to use the term mainstream media for this particular case, but that the old media can't cover.
Yeah, you could make a very valid argument that they're filling a niche that is being underserved. The perhaps legitimate concern is one of jury pool tainting. That if your podcast is coming out before this goes to trial, particularly if it is a very one with wide distribution and a large audience, you could have a significant impact on the jury pool.
I don't know.
Question
man.
Becomes.
Yeah.
And how much?
How
of
many
that
people in the jury?
Are you having
juries,
that the,
how many
the media at large isn't going to have?
Yeah.
The flip side of that coin is that there have been significant complaints apparently from police and prosecutors that this makes their job more difficult. And when I first read that, I literally wrote down, well, I have no sympathy for them. The police and the prosecution have kind of coasted on this reputation of infallible justice for a couple hundred years, and the number of wrongful convictions that have been uncovered in the past several decades is really kind of flipping the narrative on its head there for them, and they need to just stop whining and do their job better if they want to combat that, rather than saying that podcasts are the root of the issue here.
Right.
And again, this is a place where DNA evidence has done wonders, and much like most police departments aren't going to go back and retest evidence of their own accord, that you have things like the Innocence Project that are pushing that, a nonprofit group. Not every police department has the resources, nor do all the interested parties have the resources to go out and hire professional investigators or detectives to fully pursue all the possible leads here. Once the police find a case they think they can make, they want to close that. And so podcasters, if they can fill some of that need, are providing a valuable service.
Yeah, this is one of those great things, it almost sounds like.
And if they're putting out garbage, then that should be reasonably easy for the people involved to separate the wheat from the chaff there.
Yeah. All right. I know we have a couple more points on this, and then we should move on. But Aaron, I think you had a couple more points on this, and then we'll.
Yeah. Well, so I think one of the things they brought up was emotional manipulation, which certainly it is easier to do in this kind of a longer form media.
Isn't all the media emotional manipulation? Well, that really sets me off. I mean,
absolutely.
I
think the biggest piece here is the distinction between and again, this is not a podcast problem. This is a problem that faces all of media. Is where do you draw the line between education and entertainment? So in the traditional media world, you have the ever blurring line between their editorial programming and their news programming.
And again, we're looking at a news article that is really an editorial right now. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and similarly, on podcasts, you have some that are going to be, you know, just the facts, ma'am, nothing but the facts. And there are some that are they're crafting a narrative, and maybe they have a motivation that is political or moral or ethical. And maybe their motivation is, I want to paint the most captivating story I can so that I can sell more Casper mattresses or whatever the advertising product of the day is.
Well, it's interesting because I think
they're trying to build their audience around.
Here at the Local Maximum, we're in between. We go back and forth, but I think we're very open about what we do here. And I think we have an audience that's smart enough to understand.
And it's not necessarily a binary thing.
Right.
You can be somewhere on the spectrum there. And I think the place where this is a concern is where you blur that line and you do not accurately represent the story that you're telling. For example, and I would have to do some research on exactly where this falls on the spectrum. But there have been a number of podcasts I've listened to that have sold themselves, at least in their, you know, their trailers and their initial marketing, as, you know, true crime is maybe not the right term for it, but as a factual investigative podcast. And it became somewhat apparent maybe three quarters of the way through that they are heavily dramatizing some things, and there are some fictional elements to this story, and it makes for a better story, but it is not the bill of goods that I was initially sold. And and I'm perfectly fine with that. I listen to quite a bit of fiction podcasts. However, I don't like listening to what I think is investigative journalism and finding out partway through that it has been fiction all along. And A, it makes me feel cheated, and B, makes me feel like a little bit of an idiot for trusting them so far.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you have to be discerning.
Yeah, and maybe it's because I didn't do my due diligence that it's kind of part of the experience. They don't want to break the fourth wall, but if you go to their website and you look into their About Me page, maybe it says that, you know, this is actually a fictional podcast based on yada yada yada, and we're trying to sculpt this particular atmosphere. However, if you have to dig that far for it, then maybe they're doing you a disservice. It makes me think
I just want to read...
go ahead.
No, I just want to read... continue. I just want to read that last thing you wrote, because I think it's important here. You wrote, I think this is largely more sour grapes from people who feel that they got into the reporting and producing business the hard way under the old model, and they don't like seeing folks who did not come up through the same path being more successful than they are. And my response to that is, man, it's not like podcasting is easy. Like, people just start podcasting and, like, boom, they're successful and they have all this, you know. Podcasting is hard work. We've been doing this with full-time jobs for a long period of time. Most people don't get anywhere. And also, like, it's not like I, Max Sklar, am going to replace the tech press. That's not what I'm trying to do here. I'm not trying to take anyone's place. I think there are things that people who are in the tech press can do that I can't do. But I also think that given that I am an engineer, I work in the tech industry, and I study certain things, there are, like, I think that my voice has a, or my perspective has some positive contributions to add to the Podiverse conversation. And so it just seems like you can look at like one or two areas of someone making it big and being like, oh, look at these guys just getting rich right off the bat. That's not how it's happening.
Yeah, well, and that's not a something unique to podcasting. I think there's a valuable analogy to be made to the music industry in that the barrier to entry to creating a podcast is virtually nothing compared to you know, a decade or two ago. If you wanted to get onto terrestrial radio or onto, you know, network TV or even local TV, you had to work your way up through the ranks.
Right.
You know, maybe you could get onto, you know, community access television with very little effort, but that was about as far as you could get without going through the old system.
Did Weston
similarly
have
in
community access television?
I don't even know.
Oh, I would think that would be something that you would have been on.
I know that my hometown does have a community access television station. I may have watched it once.
Yeah,
but
Brooklyn does. I've been on the Brooklyn one here. Where they film it. The public access in Brooklyn is actually right across the street from my apartment, and it's in the coffee shop. And I went in the coffee shop, and then I realized, oh, that's where they film the public access stuff. And I went on there once. But anyway,
I think there are some people that they can start a podcast and have a huge audience overnight, but they are very much the exception to the rule. Much like in the music industry, you know, 20 years ago, if you wanted to get big and get distribution, you needed to get a contract because you need someone to make records or CDs and get and you know, negotiate to get you airplay on the radio. Whereas now, you can cut a track, whether it, you know, with GarageBand or something, and put it out there. You can even put it out on large distribution networks like Spotify with fairly little friction.
Yeah.
And have, you know, have access to a huge audience, even if you don't necessarily build it up overnight. There are some people who burst onto the scene and are immediate successes. Like, what was it? Elon Musk released a single not that long ago, and it got a lot of downloads. Not because
it
was
good
at
all,
but
he's Elon Musk.
But because that's what I'm saying. He's the overnight success.
However, but he's not an overnight success. It took him a long time to build his fame side.
That's because his success is elsewhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of people who have used the lower barrier of entry in music now to grind at it for years and perhaps decades and built it into a career who would never have been able to break through in the old system. Much like you were saying, succeeding at podcasting is in a sense still the hard way. There's nothing easy about it except that the barriers to entry are lower. You still have to earn every single subscription or listener that you accumulate. Nobody's going to throw that at you.
Yeah. Okay. I just want to wrap this up and draw some conclusions here and some observations. I want to support a free press. People talk about the marketplace of ideas a lot. We're not just talking about ideas here. We're talking about the marketplace of information. And it really pains me to see news publications talking about restricting the marketplace of information. It's hard to explain. I mean, podcasting has been one of the freest mediums out there. I mean, and where all of the other platforms have been closing up, big tech, of course. Look at Medium itself now. Medium, I've been talking to you recently how they've been taking down all these coronavirus articles, which is really frustrating to me. It's not like they're taking down things that are... they're taking down articles that I don't necessarily agree with, but it's very frustrating how they're starting to censor. We know that all the other ones are censoring. I learned
at least on some of the other platforms, they'll label it with, you know, with a banner that says, you know, this may contain inaccurate information or something like that. The straight pulling is I'm curious.
But
Go on. I'll loop back to this.
No, I just want to say, like, how, you know, what I learned a few weeks ago in my conversation with Naomi Brockwell, how you take laws that seem reasonable, like copyright and libel and stuff, and, you know, but then the government says, oh, okay, but the platforms aren't liable for those things, and then it's like, oh, wait a minute, if you don't want to be liable for those things, then you have to listen to us, and now you have to give us a back door to your security, and you can't do full encryption and all this stuff. So all I feel like all of these articles or call to action against bad actors, which are usually, you know, a lot of the bad actors that they talk about are dinky little podcasters that don't have any, don't have any effect on the world. Now, the Dollop people are, that's a big podcast, but still, the issue itself was not very big. And so a lot of this, I feel, is like a Trojan horse to restrict information, where really we should have broad information and good tools to separate out good information from bad information. And so I just think podcasting has been a really great way to get information. Having a single point of view is really important, because now when you have the comment section, it's like the peanut club, everybody just piles on everybody else. And it's like, oh, you're an idiot for saying that. I have a quip back, where it's like, no, sometimes you need a few minutes to explain your point of view. And even over a few episodes, over months and months, to explain how your point of view is fitting the data. And your currency as a podcaster is your personal credibility, which I think is really important. Not necessarily, when you listen to a podcaster, you're not saying, oh, I'm listening to them because a lot of people listen to them. I'm listening to them. It's usually I listen to them because I like them and because what they're saying is makes sense, and they're not putting me, like, you know, they're not taking me down the wrong road. And, you know, a lot of people on some of these other platforms are not judged in that same way. And that's why I think the Podiverse is so important. a lot of people's credibility has been tested in the last few months. You can't BS your way through the coronavirus crisis. And I don't expect people to be Nostradamus. We certainly weren't Nostradamus on this podcast in that crisis. But people need to have a degree of self-awareness when you have a very personal connection to your audience that allows you to say, hey, you know what? I was wrong about this. Let me go back and let me see where I was wrong. And, you know, and let's talk about that. Oh, an audience member wrote something in. They challenged me on this thing. Let me explain that a little bit more. And every time you do that, you gain credibility. Whereas the sniping and the articles and media, again, a lot of these newspapers, you just know it's the newspaper. You don't even know who wrote it. They just don't have to go through that. And I feel like I'm trying to think how to wrap this up here, but I just think that podcasting is a boon to getting credible information sources and not a disaster. And I think that to paint it as a disaster is really trying to keep us in the dark and keep us dependent on less credible news sources. Not that some of these newspapers aren't credible, but we have it's definitely missing something. Does that make sense?
So absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Okay. I have two things to add. One, a clarification, yeah, is that when you said we need to have a single point of view, you're not saying that we all need to toe the line. You're saying that,
oh, no,
that there's value in getting the view of an individual as opposed to kind of a mob consensus.
Right. And trying to get to know that individual, know what makes them tick, yeah, know where they're coming from. And that way you can learn from them and vice versa. Other than
podcasting has the potential to be a much more intimate interaction with the audience than many of these other platforms that we've talked about.
Right. You should absolutely get your news sources from lots of different places, but to get to know the individual places makes you much better at evaluating what they're saying versus just drinking from the fire hose.
The other thing I wanted to ask about is with the in the context of censorship and what we've been talking about off air about Medium in the last couple of weeks. Are you aware of any cases of podcast platforms? So I'm thinking, you know, is it still properly referred to as iTunes or the Apple Podcast Store?
Yeah.
And Spotify and SoundCloud. I know that many of them will tag episodes or podcasts as explicit based on their content, but are you aware of any cases of them censoring either particular episodes or dropping podcasts entirely?
I believe Alex Jones, InfoWars.
Okay, that was the one I was thinking about in the back of my head, but that's the only case I can think of that I'm aware of.
It's only censored from the podcatchers. You could still go on his website and get it.
Right.
But
and that has more to do with the decentralized nature of the internet.
Right. And it's not censored everywhere on every podcatcher, just on Apple.
Right. And I don't know if you could do this in the Apple Podcast app or not, but I know I use a third party podcast listening application. And so I can look for podcasts in any of the usual places you look, or I can just directly put a URL in there. So the decentralized nature of the internet means that I'm not dependent on a gatekeeper of one of those walled gardens determining what podcasts I am eligible to listen to.
Yeah, it's really actually kind of amazing. It's really sort of points in the direction of what something like Facebook and Twitter and all this could be if they had a different architecture, which sadly they do not. Okay, so some interesting podcast developments here. So mentioned in the article, they talk about the New York Police podcast. There's a New York City Police podcast. I did not know that before today. Did you know that?
I was not aware of it.
I'm curious exactly what
the focus is.
Well, it's kind of like the other side of true crime, where they're giving the police point of view, like, hey, we're trying to figure this out. Can anyone help us? Is my impression of it. I probably could look at it a little more. I'll link to the New York Times article about it, which is also from November. Also, a lot of politicians have been jumping on the podcast wagon. One that I wanted to mention was Newt Gingrich. I don't know. I have listened to a few of those. He started only a little over a year ago. He's former Speaker of the House in the U.S., former Republican Speaker of the House, for those of you who are listening from abroad. And so his podcast, I was very surprised to learn, was not just some former politician on the radio taking callers. It was actually like a researched, almost a tech podcast in some manner, a geopolitical podcast and a history podcast. He covers like a lot of stuff. And it's a little too like, polished. He doesn't want his personality to come through that much. Like it's edited and polished. Like he interviews the people and then it's almost like he writes the questions afterwards, and then it gets, I've done that a couple times, not going to lie, but for the most part, I don't do it, but it's like they'll listen to the interviews and they'll be like, okay, I'll ask the question that the other guy will then answer in the interview. That's an interesting one. And then of course the big news this week, is it this week or the last few weeks, is the Joe Biden podcast. Now we have presidential candidates jumping on the bandwagon.
I assume, but I could be mistaken, that it did not exist before everybody went into their isolation or stay at home. That it was spawned because of that. Although I would not be shocked to hear that it had been going on for weeks before.
No. Let's get the date of when this thing started. I'm gonna have to go to listen notes here.
Tell me more about Here's the Deal with Joe Biden.
Yeah. So Listen Notes is actually a very good podcast search engine. Because I can look at Here's the Deal with Joe Biden. All right. Oh, look at this. Look at this cover. It's almost, is that Comic Sans? I don't know if I like that.
Do not make those kind of accusations lightly, sir.
it's 3D lettering. It looks like it's a little script. It's bubble letters. The first episode was March 29th of this year. So it is absolutely when we're all forced in our homes and he's forced in his rec room, I believe. And so, there's only been three episodes so far. And so it's interesting that they're trying to do this. They're trying to pull this off, and there's been a lot of talk about this. It reminds me of my discussion with David Petruccia way back in episode 41. He's an American presidential historian. He talked about all the presidential elections over the last 100 years, how changing communications technology have changed the nature of those elections. And it almost seems like history is both progressing and also reverting back to an earlier time.
Yeah, and when you brought this up, it harkened back to something, and I may have indeed heard it in your discussion with is it, I assume it's Professor Petruccia?
I don't know.
Whatever his proper honorific is. I had to go find some evidence to back up my shady recollection, and I found a paper titled Oratorical Footing in a New Medium, Recordings of Presidential Campaign Speeches, 1896 to 1912. The piece that kind of sealed the deal for, yes, I was remembering this more or less correctly, was an article in Phonoscope, which was a journal for the recording business in 1900.
1900, wow. 120 years ago.
So more than a century ago, which said, quote, "It is now suggested that instead of making a laborious campaign, candidates devote their time at home talking into a funnel and leave the campaign committees and the phonographs to distribute their views to an admiring public." Which with the combination of coronavirus forcing our candidates to stay at home, and if you swap phonographs with podcasts, is basically exactly what's happening here. That he's using this medium as a way to talk directly to his public, his followers, people who otherwise might attend a rally or a speech or watch a debate. However, I think there, you can get a lot more people to listen to a podcast than you can get to actually show up to a physical rally.
Well, especially now.
And you can distribute that podcast to people in all 50 states when on a good day, you might be able to hit, let's say you're being real aggressive. You could do speeches in half a dozen states. So there's, you know, nothing is new here. Everything is old. But we're doing it in new ways. So I think the concept of the podcast is not bad. However, there apparently have been some serious criticisms of how Biden is particularly executing this.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's trying to do a stream of conscious podcast. It's not really edited very much. I mean, look, imagine if Trump did one. It would just be, he'd get on, he'd be like, "Today I talked to the president of Tanzania. I didn't know Tanzania. I didn't know the president. Nice guy. He was a very nice guy. You know, we talked to him." I don't know. That's how I imagine it going for like hours and hours.
I'm shocked that somehow he isn't on TikTok.
I don't know TikTok.
If Vine was still around, would he be doing that instead of tweeting?
Yeah. Maybe. But anyway, so Joe Biden's obviously certain publications are going to say podcasts are terrible no matter what. But the one I found interesting was from New York Magazine, which probably would be supportive of him. I listened to the podcast and I was like, I don't get it. I don't know why people would listen to this, but I don't think that's just one person.
I'm very curious whether people who are not already. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no, I want to read the five things because they're like, Joe Biden's podcast is bad. Here's how to make it better. And I love the five.
Lay it on us.
So the first one is, one, get Biden a co-host, which could work, but there's some danger in that. Like, what if he just has some comedian that's a co-host that people that starts taking over the show? Two, yeah, stop.
Let me drill down on a little bit further. I mean, the obvious thing would be once he picks a running mate to bring them on, because
yes,
they should be doing a lot of the things that a good co-host would do in this context. However,
that is a great idea.
There is a risk to a co-host because you don't want the perception to be that we've got someone young and hip and who knows this podcasting thing, and they're on there to keep Joe kind of on the leash and to keep him from sounding like an old fogey and a crazy person on the podcast. Because that only cements all the negative perceptions about Joe Biden. And it's going to be difficult to not create that perception because that is clearly what this person would be doing.
Yeah. So number two is stop with the Zoom, which I agree with. You don't need video on the podcast. It makes it a lot easier to edit. And then when he wants to video...
I'm surprised by how many prominent podcasters do the video, though.
Yeah. Oh, well, podcasters should do the video. I think that for Biden, he shouldn't do the video. He should put out videos, but they should be scripted, sharp videos. But if he's going to do a podcast where he just talks, it should be audio and it should be edited. Three, stop making it sound like a campaign event. That's a very common thing where you're taking one medium and not translating over another. I think he'll get better at that over time, hopefully. Four, have more episodes. Well, there's only three. I think they mean have more frequent episodes. Biden doesn't have to be on every one. I thought that was funny. That was like, okay, the problem is Joe Biden is on too many of the episodes in the Joe Biden podcast.
We're only four into the five suggestions they have for improvement, and two of them are less Joe Biden.
Yeah. And five, act like a government in waiting. I'm not sure how to do that. I'm sure they describe it more in the article, but
yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of part of the expectation was that he would be in his basement command center and showing us, you know, this is the leadership we could be having if Donald Trump wasn't in the White House.
I hope he doesn't have his phonograph in the background or his record player.
Yeah, well, it sounds like they haven't set it up with a mock set. And so absolutely, if Obama was in this position and had been secluded to his, you know, isolated to his home in the run up to his election, they would have a set there that maybe it doesn't look exactly like the Oval Office, but it looks presidential.
Right.
My understanding is that it very much looks like Biden's rarely used rec room.
Yeah. Why can't they make it look like? I know what you're talking about. Like, it has to look like, oh, this this is like if the Oval Office were designed differently, you know, but it were still the same sort of thing.
Just like, and they could do it. Obama,
well, they should have the resources to do that. There's no reason why.
Yeah. Well, because I think I may have the timeline on this wrong, but I think it was after Obama was nominated, but before the election, he started using, or maybe it was after the election, before he'd been sworn in. He started using a seal that it was not the presidential seal, but it looked a lot like the presidential seal.
Right.
And they were doing it on all of their media and their press releases and everything. And so it cemented this perception of him as the president, even though he was not yet president.
Yeah. Well, a good candidate.
If you're going to do video, you need to do it like that. Right. Not have him in his rec room, which I believe is spelled REC as in recreation, but could be substituted with WREK, because he's creating a train wreck here.
Yeah, you know, one thing I've learned from, we learned in episode 41 and elsewhere, is that good candidates are very good at using the media of their time to their advantage. And Obama really had it, and Obama would kill it with the podcasting, and Joe Biden with the podcasting, with the tweeting, he just doesn't seem to know what he's doing here. That's not a very good sign. Like, I'm sure he'll get better.
Be a bad president, but it's not making him a good candidate.
No, it's not a good sign. He'd get better, but I feel like he's got to learn real quick. And I'm worried that he's not going to be able to
with
change.
The resources,
he's not going to be. Yeah.
I was just going to say, you would think with the resources he has at his disposal, they should be able to have the best post-production and production and planning, and that this should be almost too slick. Maybe they've made a conscious decision that part of his aura, his character, is that it can't be overproduced. He needs to seem down to earth and not too slick. That the other guy, the guy he's running against, is the reality TV show and the you know, big shot media hub New Yorker, and they want to be as far away from that as possible. But that seems like a miscalculation, if it even is a calculation.
Yeah, but to add to that, I think that you didn't say like Biden thinks they need to. You said they think he needs to, and so. You're clearly making the assumption, which I think is right, is that he's not being the mastermind behind his media, how he looks and his campaign and how he's presenting himself into the world, where it really did feel like Obama was in control of that. Trump was in control of that. Trump made the final decision, not his staff, about how he was going to look.
I would certainly say that with Trump. Trump has, I think, very strong opinions on that, and is not afraid.
You wouldn't
to say
that about Obama.
No, just do it this way. I don't know if Obama personally has expertise and opinions there, or if he just managed to surround himself with people who were good at this, and he was willing to listen to what they said.
Yeah, but I feel like he had good instincts.
I'd be willing to give him the benefit of the doubt on that, and give him credit there. I'm much more confident that Trump wants things a certain way, and he says it, and that's how it gets done when it comes to anything, anything televised, for sure.
Well, it must be frustrating, because I saw in one of Trump's, long press conferences where all these people get up the other day, and someone's like, so one of the journalists gets up and said, Mr. President, Joe Biden attacked you the other day, and he said this. And Trump did not respond to the actual allegation. He was like, oh, no, Joe Biden didn't say that. He has people saying that. He has professionals tweeting for him. He didn't say that. So I don't really have to answer it. <He's> like, and you know what, though? It's sad, because you know it's true. Like, you're like, yeah, he probably didn't write that. It doesn't even sound like him, you know? And it's just unless he learns real fast, this is not going to go very well. And maybe he'll surprise us, but it doesn't seem like he's a fast learner when it comes to this, any technology that goes beyond the record player. At least that's my impression.
Well, it raises an interesting question, because the yardstick by which we've measured political candidates in the last several elections has been debate performance. That's a major way of differentiating. And I don't know if that's going to be the case going forward. That I've heard plenty of people say that, oh, Trump is going to, you know, wipe the floor with him at the debates. And I don't know if that's true or not. I
don't know.
They certainly have very different debate styles. And so,
right. They're so it's probably, not, they're going to be passing ships in some ways.
Yeah. Both teams are going to come out of it thinking that they've won a resounding victory. And we'll see what the public at large determines. But I think a lot of what's going on outside of the debate stage is going to sway the average voter. And it's going to be less and less, the daytime talk shows or the nightly news programs. You know, it's not going to be the one-on-one sit down on 60 Minutes or Barbara Walters or whatever the current equivalent is for the candidate. It's going to be the little snippets, the quips at press conferences, the tweets, and maybe the occasional longer form release. But I think debates are losing their currency.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Maybe. The idea of the vice presidential candidate being the co-host is very interesting.
Tipped his hat is not the right term there, but he's committed to having a female running mate.
Right. I have a predicted thing on that. I think yes, he will have a woman as his running mate, but I think that. I predict it thinks it's going to be Kamala Harris, and I bet against that. We'll see what happens. They also predicted she would be the nominee, and they were wrong on that. I won betting against that too. But
I think more interesting at this point, from a strategic point of view, is will he wait to the convention to announce his running mate?
It sounds like he won't.
Given that the convention is highly likely to be not a traditional convention, given what's going on in the U.S. right now, that it will either be very lightly attended or perhaps entirely virtual, that waiting to unveil your running mate there is less valuable. And I think he could use a big media boost that this could provide sooner rather than later. That being said, there's also a lot of talk about potential upsets of the convention. So who knows where we'll be in, when is it? Is it June?
No. It's moved to August. They moved it.
Okay. Yeah. So who knows where we'll be? Yeah, that's right. Because a lot of the primaries were moved into June.
I don't see
who knows where we'll be in August.
I don't see them being able to do that. I don't see them being able to replace the candidate. I know a lot of people are talking about Cuomo should be the candidate. What are they going to do? Are they going to say, oh, we had 25 candidates for you and you selected one, you voted on them, but you know, we're just going to throw all that out. We're going to pick someone different.
I mean, there have been dark horse candidates before.
Yeah, but it was before there was the primaries. So we'll see. It's always very fascinating. This election is turning out to be even more fascinating than I thought at the beginning. We've been focused on the Democratic candidates for like over a year now, and it turned out that everything that they were talking about is now irrelevant pretty much. And so we're in just a whole new era, and it's going to be a wild ride. I am very lucky to have a podcast this year. This is the first presidential election year that I have a podcast. So I had the radio show in 04. That 04's election was... As elections go, it was interesting, but it wasn't the most interesting in our lifetime. Yeah. Of course, every year they're like, this is the most important election of our lifetime. Even in 2004, they were saying that. But, you know,
because no newscaster is going to say, this is a relatively unimportant election and you shouldn't pay attention to what we're about to tell you.
Yeah, but
might as well stay home.
say might as well stay home, but yeah.
I'm curious what the reach for Biden's podcast is, that are people listening to his podcast who were not already going to vote for him? Cause I
can't see it. I mean,
And so if he's preaching to the converted, what is his objective? If his objective is to keep people motivated so that he reduces the odds of people deciding to stay home on election day, then this could be a very viable way to do it. If he thinks that this podcast is going to win him over moderates and independents and swing voters, or even some of those blue collar Trump voters, I don't think he's going to make any inroads with this particular format.
Yeah, you got to take risks with the podcast. You got to make it interesting. You have to talk about. Well, and look, I mean, he's not going to talk about something like new technology that's going to take pictures of everyone's butthole. That's not going to. That's not going to fly.
Unless the stance pro or con for that gets onto the platform.
Yeah.
I can imagine Bernie Sanders having a rant about that.
But he would.
Joe Biden.
I am very concerned about the toilets. I was told I should not do a Bernie Sanders impression, but I could just imagine. I would listen to that. You know what? I'm not a Sanders supporter. I would totally listen to that. If he were to rant about the toilet technology and if someone sent me a link and said Bernie Sanders rants about, you know, about big data, even if it were like less racy or whatever, or privacy, I would listen to it. It would just be kind of inherently interesting. And so Biden's got to figure out a way to make that happen. But
I mean, maybe that's his play here, is that by putting something out, maybe not everybody's going to listen to it, but people in the news media are probably going to listen to it and dissect it. And so it's a chance for them to pull sound bites to keep him in the headlines when he can't go and shake hands and go to rallies. And he could still, you know, call in to and video in to news shows for interviews. But what does he have to add to the, you know, 24/7 we're all going to die coronavirus coverage, other than being a counterbalance to Trump potentially?
Well, here's an analogy that I found interesting that someone suggests, some people have suggested online. They compare this election to the one in 1920, exactly 100 years ago, where there had just been a pandemic as well, and as well as a lot of really crazy things happening in the country that year. Again, that's David Petruccia wrote a whole book on that in 1920. In that case, it was the Republican saying, "Hey, I'm just a boring guy." Turned out he was not that boring, but he's like, "Hey, I'm just a boring guy, and I'm going to return the country," and not necessarily in a good way, but "I'm just a boring guy, and we're going to return to normalcy. I'm going to be a caretaker president, and we're going to return the normalcy. We're just going to try to get things back to normal after World War One. After even interestingly enough, the Spanish flu pandemic wasn't even a factor in that campaign. Maybe a little bit, but there was terrorism in the USA, social change, all this stuff. And you know what? He won in a landslide from that because people were tired of all the craziness. And so there is a suggestion that maybe Biden has a chance if people are tired of all the craziness. Although I look online, I'm like, are people tired of the craziness, or are they pathologically asking for more? Even if they're on the left versus on the right, people are just not. It might not be time for that. But I thought it was an interesting analogy, particularly since it was exactly 100 years.
Yeah, I guess it remains to be seen.
Yeah. All right. So I have an interesting channel, a YouTube channel that I found that I want to share with everyone. I really liked it because I've been stuck at home in my apartment here for a long time, pretty much a month. And I'm like, I need something to do. So I look around YouTube, and most of it is a waste of my time. But this one really made me smile. And it was Translator Fails. Who is the, who is the woman who does these? I should get the
is it Melinda Kathleen Reese?
Okay, yeah, no, she does a great job. They're very well produced, and basically what she does is she runs songs and stuff through like songs from Hamilton or songs like Havana or other things, and she runs it through Google Translate multiple times. It doesn't really work if you run it through once or just a few languages, so I don't know exactly what she's doing, but she's running it so that Google Translate mangles the song, and it's really, really hilarious. Like, she actually acts out what it comes up with, and so I'm just, I don't know if I should go into some of the specifics here, what happened, but you guys should just check it out. It's really funny. It's Translator Fails on YouTube. I will post it in the show notes page. All right, let's sort of wrap it up on podcasting in general as a I just want to bookend this with, you know, the podcasting medium is still growing. It's not saturated. It's not coming to an end. It's not leading us all to our doom. We now have a recent article come out saying that there are 100 million total listeners to podcasts right now. I think we dipped a little bit during, even though people have time to do podcasts at home. That was the one thing that you could do on your commute. So maybe people have less time to do podcasts now. But I think podcasts, once things get back to normal, podcasts will continue to grow. They are growing. We truly unbundled talk radio because there could only be a certain number of radio stations became syndicated, and there was only room for a certain number of radio hosts, a certain number of stations. There's room for many, many podcasters, many flavors. And I personally, I don't just listen to the big podcasts. I find some smaller podcasts that I like where I feel like I trust the host. And and then you kind of get to know the host more personally. And I think we could, and I think people like to consume podcasts along those lines. So it's a very exciting medium to be in right now. And it's not leading us to our doom. It's leading us to the opposite of that. Everything else in the world is leading us to our doom right now. So that's all I wanted to say about that to wrap up this whole discussion and bookend it. Aaron, do you have any last words before we head out?
No, just I'm going to keep trying to focus on things that are not coronavirus because I'm getting enough input on that without even trying.
All right. I'll try to look into the models when I can. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxSklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.